One big beautiful bill has passed the House. The House actually did something. They violated their own rules. They may be driving us off a fiscal cliff, and it barely worked at all, but they did a thing. And it wasn't naming a new post office, which is somewhat amazing, right? He's just somewhat shocked. It's like, hey, they passed something.
It was beautiful. It was very beautiful. There's some ugly in it. there's some hints of ugly.
The end of the Republic might be the end of the ugliness, but we'll see.
We'll see. Welcome back to Human Reaction. Play the thing. Play the thing.
Do the thing.
Do the thing. If you want to support the show, make sure to comment down below. Help us drive the algorithm.
Yeah.
Help us fight Google in the algorithmic space.
Our check from Qatar is in the mail.
Yeah.
So we need support. So get those comments in there, guys.
Yeah, we haven't quite gotten that yet. Maybe MBS can help us out. I don't know.
We need the headdress. That was what we missed. Is like we forgot to wear the headdresses on the day where we revealed
you
our
see Tim Dillon did that.
Yeah, I know. It was so much better than us.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Damn, we can't compete with Tim Dillon.
See, we didn't get our paycheck yet, so we didn't have the budget for
it's
a tiger.
It's a chicken and egg problem.
We didn't have a tiger budget.
Yeah, no tiger budget.
This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
Yeah, so we're going to be talking about the big, beautiful bill. I have a meme I pulled from the Discord from Cheryl in the Discord. It says, Republicans versus Democrats. Republicans, we lie to you and steal your money. Well, Democrats, we steal your money and lie to you. It's a difficult choice.
Thumbs up, yeah. Well, that's kind of what it feels like right now, because even when I hear all the Democrats dog on this, they're like, the bill is so large. I'm like, screw you, dude. You don't get to complain about this now. That's my thing. You don't get to take my thing, okay? They didn't give us enough time to read it. It's like, really, Nancy Pelosi? We gotta pass it to find out what's in it? You're the person who gets to say this? No, you don't get to say this.
That is the thing. At least we kind of knew what was in it going into it. It wasn't like a Nancy Pelosi thing necessarily.
Yeah, it was a little bit
better. But it is still a massive bill where it's like...
Well, and they did change the rules, right? So they voted on it at midnight. And they voted on it with dramatic changes right beforehand. So, yeah, it wasn't the 72-hour rule, according to some of the congressional sources.
Yeah.
So how did it pass, Kyle?
Well, so what we ended up having here, it only passed by one vote. So we had 215 Republicans voting yay, and then 212 Democrats voting nay, with two Republicans also voting nay.
Mm.
That was Thomas Massie and Davidson.
Yes.
I think that was the second one. Then there was also some no votes as well in there. But yeah, I mean, Thomas Massie was the one that made the big stink about it, right? Mm-hmm. I think everybody knows that he's the kind of the most popular person that was on the opposition side of this.
He's got a bigger microphone because he's been consistently great, mm-hmm. right? And also X likes him a lot because he's been consistent and great. You got to wonder, like, you know, is he on track here? I mean, this is one of the things that's difficult about these issues. Taxes and spending are the most important thing the government does, right? It is the government. That is what defines government. But we have a hard time getting people interested in the question of taxes and spending. It's so strange. The government takes your money at the force of a gun, and people are like, I just can't get excited about the taxing and spending.
Even though it's like the most direct thing that really applies to you.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's like the money in your bank account, right?
Right. And if Thomas Massie is right, and this is an inflationary, terrible thing that's going to drive up the deficit, bankrupt the country, and all these sorts of things, and we'll be diving into his comments more directly in a minute, but if that's true, then this is the future of the country is at stake, and it's like difficult, even like you look around on like... you know, podcasts and stuff like that, people aren't really talking that much about it. There's like a couple like very news podcasts talking about it. And there's reasons for that, partially because I'm sure that we're going to see changes in the Senate now. But I think this begins the dialogue about the future of our country way more than most other things, other than, you know, foreign policy questions.
Yeah. And it's also, I don't want to paint it as too much of it's just all awful in here, because there's good things that exist in here. It's just like the things that I would have liked to see more of was more cuts.
Yes.
That's the thing that I would have liked to see more of, because it is going to be driving the deficit up like $4 trillion.
Yeah.
But like there are good things. Like one of the best things in here is the permanent tax changes that come from the tax cuts of 2017. Mm-hmm. It's like all that stuff was going to be expiring at the end of the year.
Which is a big deal.
So like if we didn't get these made permanent, we would have ended up seeing everybody's taxes would have been going up after this.
That's right.
So like that is the good thing about this. And it's the thing that Trump kind of had to get past. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of concessions that probably have to be made in that result. But unfortunately, a lot of those concessions are, we just didn't get that many spending cuts. Like right. we got some good spending cuts, some, but it's just like, we didn't get a lot.
Yeah. Well, and we also increased spending in lots of areas as well. So let's dive into what the tax cuts are. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act from 2017 changed a lot of what would change individual and business taxes. It reduced business taxes substantially. The U.S. had one of the higher business tax rates in the world. It's now kind of sitting in the middle of the pack, far more competitive for reshoring, one of the major Trump's goals, And it, you know, definitely played a role in the dynamism that we saw in the later Trump years leading into COVID. In fact, it was probably indicative of one of the best case examples we have of the Laffer curve. So the Laffer curve is this idea that there's a point of return in your tax rate where if you tax too much, you're actually getting less revenue. Mm-hmm. What happened after the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is receipts actually increased business creation, increased economic expansion, meant more taxes coming into the government while the economy grew and people became wealthier. The challenge with that is they also increased spending that year. Because Trump 1.0 was also bad on spending.
They doubled the spending that came from his predecessor, Obama.
Exactly. And that's even before COVID, he was bad on spending, though. And keep important to remember that, right? So is it too much to ask for him to be good on spending this time? You know, that's one of the things. His campaign promises was that he would be different on that without ever apologizing for the past.
Well, and a lot of this, too, is just, you got the mess that is the executive branch. You got Congress, like all this stuff, right? Like,
yep.
You need a lot of political will to cut massive amounts of spending. Mm-hmm. Like that's the unfortunate reality. And that's kind of the place that we're in. I don't know if we had a president that was just, we knew was going to be better on spending. Like, I don't even know how much better the spending cuts would have been even then.
Yes.
Right? You know, that's the unfortunate reality that we live in. Right,
because now. Congress is so short-sighted and unfunctional and terrible.
They got to go back to their districts with like, I got this program in for you guys, like all that stuff, right?
I mean, if you look at the defense spending, you know where that's coming from. You know it's coming from areas that have Boeing and Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and those kind of manufacturing in their states, and they're trying to protect their state's interest. And the unfortunate part of that is that they're prioritizing that over the welfare of the entire country, which is a real tragedy. So, but let's go, before we get to the spending bit, let's go through the temporary tax increases. So
he's actually taxing tips more. I'm kidding.
The incentives, I think, are really important. Is why is there so much temporary tax changes in this bill? For the same reason that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was there, is because Republicans have learned a lesson, which is that you don't want to make permanent changes, at least in the beginning. Because one, it makes it easier to pass, right? You can get your foot in the door and widen that door open. Mm-hmm. Two, it gives you something to run on for the future, right? There's no doubt that Republicans ran a lot on keeping the tax rates the way they are. And then you put the Democrats on the back foot, because then if they do nothing, even if you lose, they are now forced into a position of either accepting your policy or raising taxes, something that not even Democrats like to do. Everyone loves deficits, except for fiscal hawks. So, First up is no tax on tips,
which was a big campaign promise. Just overall promises kept, I guess. It's no tax on tips unless you're an individual earning over $160,000, which, I mean, how many people making a lot of tips are making over $160,000. Like
strippers.
Strippers. OnlyFans models.
I don't know. I mean, super chats, do they count as tips or income?
Yeah, I don't know.
Give us a super chat.
If we were live, give us a super chat.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, so the what counts is actually a good question for this particular section of the code, in that it kind of makes a suggestion that the Department of Treasury is going to list like a definitive list of eligible occupations for this.
That's something I was going to ask, because I foresee a lot of loopholes with this, where it's like, you know, you go to get your haircut, and instead of it being a $40 haircut or whatever, you're just like, I'll pay you $1, but I'll tip you $39.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Right, exactly. So there's going to be probably a lot of rulemaking around it to do that. Now, that does mean you have to actually declare your tips on your taxes, which most people don't do. A lot of people don't do. So that will be an interesting part of it as well. Now, more people are moving digital, so because it makes it harder not to include your tips on your tax. That's why a lot of people like to tip in cash, because it goes directly to the person. They don't have to pay taxes on it. So, well, actually, they probably should. I think the IRS has been somewhat vague about that over time. The normal practice of tipping with cash is now like not as incentivized, right? You can now tip with your credit cards.
The other big thing on the employee standpoint is overtime wages, no tax on overtime, which was another promise that was made on the campaign trail. Which, I mean, again, that's like one of those things where it's like, great, that's cool. Like,
well, especially for the working class folks who are the number one leverage point for the Democrats to criticize Republican tax priorities. This is an important component of that, right? Because it's not salary people who are going to benefit from this, which is mostly your white collars, right? It's going to be more people who are billing hourly and, you know, aren't independent contractors. So each of those that narrows down substantially who benefits from it. Now, it is people making under $160,000 annual. Once again, a lot of wage rate don't go that high anyways. So that's going to benefit most of those folks. And then, but you still got to pay your regular taxes on those. It's just no income tax on your overtime pay. You'll still have to pay Social Security, Medicaid, and unemployment and all that.
Not punishing you for being an overachiever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Then there also came various tax reliefs on businesses. I mean, these are just kind of like, they're just kind of across the board. I think it's just like much more business friendly environment across the board.
Okay. Right? Yeah, I didn't get into that part. So when I'm kind of worried about with that section is what are the sort of things we're talking about in terms of particular benefits to businesses, right? So remember like the yacht tax, right? Is this the yacht tax again?
Explain the yacht tax. I vaguely remember.
Well, there was a special tax on yachts, and one of the controversies of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, it was one of the things that got cut.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So I don't know what these are, but
there's certain things about like pass through taxes, like if you have an LLC, things like that. There's a lot of like these small business LLC types of taxes that I saw. I didn't go into the nitty gritty of it because it's just like boring tax policy that I didn't think would be, you know, of particular interest to everybody. But it's just like a lot of like small business taxes like that overall, just at a glance, looked like they'd be net beneficial for anybody that runs small businesses.
Right. What I assume is what we'll see is the Democrats will come out and they'll pick out some examples like the yacht tax, and they're going to be like, we got a tax for golf courses. We got to tax golf courses. Only rich people go there.
Trump owns golf courses.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
Well, actually, that is a funny thing is as one of the things, this is just a slight aside, but in the same vein, is Democrats are now trying to propose an amendment on either the Stable Act or the Genius Act, which are the stablecoin bills that are making their way through the House and the Senate right now, to make it so that presidents cannot benefit from cryptocurrency.
Oh, really?
They're trying to put like a no cryptocurrency for presidents like clause inside of the stablecoin.
And that's because of the Trump coin, right?
Well, particularly it's because of Eric and Don Jr. with their World Liberty Financial endeavor that they're involved in, which Trump's not even in, right? You know, it's like the kids. So it's just kind of like a punishing the kids thing. But they are doing that type of a thing, you know, that they're trying to propose. Just kind of an interesting little aside. One thing that was surprising to me that I didn't see in here, and this was a campaign promise, so this didn't make it in, was taxes on Social Security.
Yeah, which was supposed to go to, was the promise to go to zero with that?
Yeah, or cut it massively or something of that regard. I did see a clip from a congressman who was talking about it. He was asked about this, I think on like Fox Business or something. And he said it is so difficult. Like they really tried to get it through, but it was so difficult to make work. And with the other things that people wanted, where it was one of the things that was on the docket, but it ended up having to be cut in order to make concessions for other people on stuff.
Yeah.
And it was just like, it was, they would have had to make all of these, try to find revenue somewhere else. Like this would have been a thing that would have massively ballooned up the deficit, actually, is if they took that route. And they would have had to make a lot of concessions in order to make it happen.
One of the challenges is and that's the structure of our tax code challenge that they have to grapple with. Your wealthiest people in society, the people who have been around the longest to accrue assets that appreciate with inflation. So when you reduce taxes on Social Security, you're reducing taxes on your wealthiest, most likely to own assets people. Now, there are people who draw Social Security don't have a lot of assets, right? But the challenge is you have all that money moving through the system by the government that you now can't touch if you reduce it to zero. So what I assume is what we'll wind up with in this bill through the Senate is at best some of this sort of reduction in terms of like a credit rather than an actual cut because your alternatives are so bad. Right, you have to increase the taxes on income tax, or you got to, you know, whatever, or you got to cut spending, which they're unwilling to do. More radical than this, and they still, even as like I think in net these tax cuts are a good thing. If you don't cut to address the spending, you're running into problems, right? And they can't. I mean, they have to. They have to be more aggressive on that.
Where the problem with the bill is. Is like there are a lot of good things on the tax cut perspective. Have you not been?
I just realized that.
Have you not had your headphone on this whole time? Joe and Bennett are here, and just everything falls
apart. I don't even know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I just got into it. I was just excited to.
I'm learning how to produce, though. That's what happens. Well, and it is also the thing is like it is the baby boomers that this would be affecting greatly right now. And that is just such a big generation, like just the sheer amount of revenue. I wish I had like a number in front of me of like how much tax revenue that would have actually been that would have just been cut, you know, and. Yeah.
Well, and
the baby boomers, big voting block, they're like that's unfortunate. I feel like they would have, you know, this is kind of like the big thing where it's like. Trump's base in a lot of ways. they're not getting the benefits that was expected there.
But that's true. But it's also true that, you know, what we're running into is the challenge of the way that the tax system currently organized, which is to to go after the people who are most wealthy first. And by doing it this way, they're at least maintaining some of those most wealthy people in society paying more taxes. Not to say that I'm like supportive of that, but rather this is just the incentive structure that we have to play into, right? Because otherwise, you got to raise taxes someplace else or cut more spending.
Yeah, we got to tax the rich, the boomers.
That is how the system works, unfortunately. All right, so expanded SALT deduction cap. This is a major, major controversial one. So the SALT deduction is where you can deduct out of your federal taxes your state taxes. Really, what this benefits is not the low tax states. It actually benefits the highest tax state. So if you're a Republican from New York, you're fighting like mad for SALT deduction for your constituents. The challenge with that is those are the moderates who are easiest to work with on the spending issue or have no problem with deficits. And those people are the people who are going to fight you on Medicaid. But then what they really want in this bill is SALT. Now, the real challenge of that for policy is it creates an incentive where there's no punishment for your state to increase its tax burden. Right. And now you're paying less in those states.
Interesting.
You're saving money, right? And therefore your states have a great incentive to increase their taxes.
Yeah. Interesting. Kind of reminds me of a lot of the stuff that goes on in Canada with what Alberta's all pissy about and why they want to join America.
Oh.
Is there's kind of this like the big, more populated states that make less money versus the smaller, less populated states that make all the money, and how that distribution kind of works and
classic.
Kind of the incentives around it.
Yeah, that's a battle that goes back to ancient Rome.
Yeah.
Right?
It is
rural
actually.
Populace versus the urban populace, and like the real challenge of the how taxes bring people into conflict with one another that otherwise wouldn't be in conflict. So SALT was a major one, and it's raised to $40,000 for incomes under $500,000. So you can deduct up to $40,000 on your SALT. And now, of course, now that too, because all those states are progressive states, almost all their tax burden shifted to the wealthy. This is another thing that's going to be attacked because it only really benefits the wealthiest people in those areas.
You know, there were some other, and you know, it's kind of funny. Trump had floated the idea out a couple months ago of putting a like child tax credit up to like $10,000, or like paying people for like paying people for having kids and just like giving or like even floated the idea of like subsidizing it in a sense. But child tax credits did increase from 2,000 to 2,500.
Yep.
So there is kind of that endeavor, you know, Elon Musk eating good there.
Yeah. You know, the child tax credit is one of the things that most directly benefits the middle class out of a lot of these. You know, I think some of these other things do as well. But if you're in that position where you have a couple kids, that extra $500 is no small thing. It's hard to have kids. Mm-hmm. So things that smooth those out. Now, there is a very pro-natalist kind of movement internationally, looking at Viktor Orban of Hungary and other states that are working to try to make it smoother for, you know, and reduce the perverse incentives, the bad incentives to having kids, because you have to grow your society. Otherwise, your infrastructure fails.
Yeah, it's like not just a philosophical thing, but actually just like the systemic structures in place of Western countries. It's just, it makes it more natural just not to have kids or whatever, just because of like it's punishing in a sense financially.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple different reasons for it. At least one of them that's always been interesting to me is there's a quality and quantity economic thinking that applies to children, in the sense that there was a quantity when child death rates were high, there was a quantity incentive, right? Because you got to get to those filters of, you know, the diseases that would kill children. And not to mention the risks of birth. But also there's a lot that has gone into, because of our tax structure, has made it harder for people to have large families, because you need more property is taxed, your consumption goes up, your consumption taxes go up because you got to pay consumption tax on your children, you know, and then to get the relief on income taxes is probably a net good, from the perspective that we shouldn't, you know, less taxes equals good.
In the same vein of a very pro-natalist policy, this is something that you added in here that I actually hadn't seen, was a creation of a $1,000 savings account for children born between 2024 and 2028, with annual parental contributions up to $5,000. What is that?
Yeah,
what is going on there?
Basically, if you have a kid born between 2024 and 2028, making this a temporary program, of course, like the rest of everything we've been mentioned so far, the way that does is the government starts a $1,000 savings account in the name of that kid, controlled by the parents. You can then contribute to $5,000 to that account. That reduces your taxable liability for that year. And then that kid then has that account to accrue interest on and things like that, so that when they become an adult, they have a substantial savings account.
What can that money be used for? Is it just like it goes to the kid later on, or is it like it goes to their education?
I found no rules on what it was, other than that's a
account. When can they pull from it? Do we know that?
Reach majority when they
get, like at 18, they can just, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. That is.
It's another like, you know, pro-natalist sort of approach.
And tax benefits for doing that makes sense.
Yeah.
Encourages saving. It's interesting. In the same vein as like an education savings account or a health savings account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Huh. And it's just another way in which they're trying to encourage savings. Now, one of the things is this whole savings push, that's everything from college savings accounts to healthcare savings accounts, to all these things are all exist in order to fight the fundamental incentive that we have to not save. And the reason why we have a fundamental incentive not to save is because we have artificially created interest rates that make it punishing to save. If you save money outside of a Roth IRA or something like that, you are fighting that impulse to consume, because interests are a signal for consumption. If interest rates are low, it says consume now, don't save. If interest rates are high, it says save, don't consume now. Now, the challenge is just like, you know, they're trying to create policies to fight the thing that they've established for like 40 years now of low interest rates. I know it doesn't feel low now, but it is low now compared to the historical average if you go over, you know, 200 years. So,
Something I want to shift us to spending, because
we got one more.
Oh, yeah,
that's really important for the middle class.
Oh, go ahead.
The auto loan deduction.
Oh, yeah, I skipped over that.
Yeah. So you can now deduct auto loan interest payments up to $10,000. That's a big deal for the auto industry. It's a big deal for people who take out auto loans, which is going to trend lower in demographics because auto loans are tremendously risky. It's not tremendously risky, but it is a risky situation because autos deteriorate in value so much so quickly. And interestingly, it doesn't have a couple bounds on it. The deduction applies to passenger vehicles with final assembly in the United States. And it does have an income requirement. You have to make less than $100,000 for single filers and less than $200,000 for joint filers.
Interesting. So, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, and that's actually so, because before we shift to spending, like pretty much everything here on the tax side of things, I'm down with. Like, and I think any conservative libertarian is pretty happy with how the tax side of things looks. Like, could have been better, whatever. You know, it could be, right?
Sure. Like, on the margin, you're happy about progress, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't even think even the biggest critics from the right are really that beefed up about it. I don't even think they're even really that upset about some of the spending, depending on the spending project, like the border or the Golden Dome. It's just the other things, right? It's the general outlook of what's going on.
Well, but it's like the offsets and like how this looks on the deficit, right? Like, right. Could there have been more spending cuts? We were kind of promised more spending cuts. Like, those are the types of things that people have gripes with. When we're looking at all like these individual things, you're just like, yeah, that's good. That's good. That's good. That's fine.
I mean, I can quibble with the savings account thing. It's just like, no, just do something about the incentive not to save.
Yeah.
But you can also say, like, in the lieu of not being able to do that, is this a marginally better alternative? Well, sure, but maybe just stop taxing all money that goes into savings. Why do it this way with a government-controlled account? You know, like there's probably better alternatives there. But
I agree with that.
Yeah. You can quibble. But yeah, I agree. In net, increasing the standard deduction for up to $1,000 for individuals and $2,000 for joint filers, you're looking at a little bit less taxes for your average person who uses standard deduction, which is going to be your people who have less complicated finances and less, business owners, people like that. So you're going to have a lot more people in the middle who are not paying as much taxes, which is a good thing.
Well, one of my problems with just the structure of how this all went down, of having just one big, beautiful bill, right? Like, I always worry about just these massive bills when I was like, I kind of wish Congress would vote on like the pieces within the bill, and it's like yes, yes, no, no, yes, no, yes. I wish that there was more of that.
Like how Congress should.
It is one of those things. Like maybe that's too much to ask for. Maybe that's really more complicated than I think it is. But I don't feel like it should be. But yeah. There's kind of that aspect to it where it's like, there's things in here I don't like. There's things in here I do like, and it's just like I wish that they could be like pulled apart. And that's where guys like Thomas Massey or Rand Paul often have their gripes, where they end up voting no on something that goes against their party or whatever. And it's just like, yeah, I like this, this, and this in the bill, but it's just like, I can't vote for this other thing.
Right.
Right? Like that's the struggle that happens with these massive bills like this. Right.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a reasonable criticism because that's how Congress is supposed to behave, right? So Congress is supposed to have a budget bill that is separate from your tax bill. It is supposed to have a budget reconciliation process that actually has something to do with actual policies that are passed and paying for them, not this process that we're currently going through, much less the process that that isn't 16 different bills that is then turned into a budget. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, and that's how your state legislators work all the time, right? They do have a giant budget bill that goes through a process that each department is funded and then is kind of synergized with a tax cut that year, right? That's not the process we're going through, though. We're doing a back end of that. We're cutting taxes first, and we're not actually changing the spending fundamentally other than increasing spending and then doing some long-range cuts.
With some vague, because like, my understanding of the Mike Johnson strategy is that the spending cuts are supposed to be a multi-year phased approach.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I'm like, okay, like if that's true and that works, okay, I'm cool with that. But it's like, the question is that going to happen? Like, are we actually going to get multi-phases of spending cuts? Is the incentive there to do so? Every time we kind of kick down the can down the road, It doesn't happen. You know, like that's the concern that I have here, where it's just like, I'm down. Like if it works, then it's good. It's just like, I have qualms with it working. Like will it work? That's the problem I have. I hope it works. Like,
totally.
That's the, like, I'm not praying for the downfall.
The question is, yeah. Are you being naive?
Yeah.
Or are you being Thomas Massie?
Well, and that's the thing. So, like, I want to play Thomas Massie's clip here from his House speech. Mm-hmm. He had a pretty powerful House speech. And, you know, he got a lot of, you know, critiques. You had Trump criticizing him, calling him a grandstander.
He's a grandstander. He does his it hair's not even as good as Rand Paul's.
I would say Thomas Massie, he has, like, I don't know. He's got more pizzazz to him over the last year. Him growing out the beard and stuff.
The beard is so alpha.
He looks more Chad.
Yes.
And it is funny because Thomas Massie, that is when he started following me, is when I told him that he looks like a Chad. but here is Thomas Massie on the floor.
Gentleman from Kentucky is recognized for 90 seconds.
Well, I'd love to stand here and tell the American people we can cut your taxes and we can increase spending and everything's going to be just fine. But I can't do that because I'm here to deliver a dose of reality. This bill dramatically increases deficits in the near term, but promises our government will be fiscally responsible 5 years from now. Where have we heard that before? How do you bind a future Congress to these promises? This bill is a debt bomb ticking. Congress can do funny math, fantasy math, if it wants, but bond investors don't. And this week, they sent us a message. Moody's downgraded our credit rating, and the bond investors who buy our debt and finance our debt demanded higher interest rates on the 10-year note, the 20-year note, and the 30-year note. What does this mean? Very soon, the government will be paying $16,000 of interest alone per U.S. family. And what are we telling them? Instead of taking care of that problem, we're going to give you a $1,600 tax break. Under the taxing and spending levels in this bill, we're going to rack up, the authors say, $20 trillion of new debt over the next 10 years. I'm telling you, it's closer to $30 trillion of new debt in the next 10 years. Mr. Speaker, we're not rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic tonight. We're putting coal in the boiler and setting a course for the iceberg. If something is beautiful, you don't do it after midnight. I oppose this bill.
Gentleman's time has expired.
Is that a club reference?
it's sort of like Congress
got their beer goggles on, man. This isn't beautiful.
It's sort of like, I think that's like a How I Met Your Mother quote. It's like nothing good happens after 2 a.m.
Yeah,
something.
right. So his major criticism, if I understand it right, is this is a rug pull. This is saying we're going to cut this and you trust us, we're going to get to tax cuts, but they never, ever do. And you can understand
spending
from Thomas... Spending cuts, but they never, ever do. And you got to understand that Thomas Massie has been in Congress for quite some time now, right? He's been in there for like a decade. He's seen this game before. When is it going to happen, right? And I think his skepticism is legitimate.
I think anybody's skepticism is legitimate towards that. And like he mentioned the bond rates, the recent auction on bonds did not go super well. Bonds went up to 5%.
I've read 6%.
Really?
Yeah.
I was looking at the market. It was just 5.
It might have been the day after.
It was like 5.1 or something.
Wow.
But now markets are fickle and I suspect that that's going to go down and kind of even out much more around like the 4.5% rate here soon. But Bessent's goal is to bring them down to 3.5%. Mm-hmm. And like every one of those basis points is like $100 billion on the interest, right?
So that's a major, and it
shows that people, bond buyers, are worried about the fiscal responsibility of the United States going forward.
Right. Here. So think of risk. Mm-hmm. Interest rates exist to navigate risk. So if something is risky, you increase the interest rate. Mm-hmm. When you're looking at the question of buying a bond, you're asking yourself, will the United States be capable of paying this off? If you're passing a tax cut bill before you've cut spending, you're now looking at a question of, well, will the United States be able to continue paying their debts? So therefore, there's a pressure for the interest rates to go up. When we were going through the plan, mm-hmm. the Trump plan of the trade war with all these other elements, your case was they need this to go down. And a lot of this is to spur, you know, economic chaos to try to draw the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates. in the markets to face the incentives to also accept lower interest rates.
Just the natural bond price, what people are willing to pay for bonds. Like they want to increase demand for bonds. And one thing is, I think Powell this summer will probably start cutting interest rates. The Fed in general is, they've made it pretty clear that there's probably going to be two rate cuts this year.
Yeah. But
that's just going to be like 0.25 and 0.25.
But even if they do, and the market is all saying, that's insane, look how risky this is, mm-hmm. the actual payment of the rates on the bond market will be higher, right?
No. I foresee what the future, like I'm actually more so looking at the fall. I actually think most of what's happening in the summer is a little bit. Now, the unfortunate thing is a lot of debt is maturing over the summer, like a lot of debt. But I suspect, and just kind of my read on the economic winds, is this fall is where a lot of things start coming into place. So unfortunately, a lot of that debt that's getting refinanced over the summer, it's going to be happening at these higher bond rates. Mm-hmm. I suspect a lot of the trade war stuff, because a lot of the negotiations will now have come through. A lot of tariffs, like what we know, like uncertainty around the tariffs will become more solidified. Mm-hmm. And then we'll start to see a lot of more of this because of tax cuts, because of interest rates going down, et cetera. We're going to start to see a lot more liquidity in the economy, which is going to, I think, reassure investors for buying in the bond market. And also, I think that there's just an element of, whose bonds are you buying besides America's? Like, you're not buying Canadian bonds, right? You're not buying European bonds. You're not doing that. I think that there's going to be a lot of that. So right now the market's fickle. Like, this is like short-term price action. Right. I think the real bond rate is probably around 4.5 right now. Mm. Like, you're probably getting it at a steal at this moment. Mm. But we need to get it down to 3.5, 3%, right?
Like, yeah. What he's citing is, we need that, because otherwise we're paying insane amounts of money on the existing debt we already have, mm-hmm. because they've consistently said this since 2001. We have to do this because we're in an emergency, but don't worry, eventually we'll get around to cutting something. Well, right? And then it just goes the same thing, is we're going to cut social spending or we're going to cut defense. And then the Republicans say social spending and the Democrats say defense. The Democrats, even when in office, don't cut defense. And when Republicans in office, don't even cut social spending. Until now.
Well, and this is the thing, is because our debt to GDP ratio, which is basically, it's our country's total public debt, mm-hmm. Over top of our economic output, is 121%, which is large. Like, that's a large number. For reference there, Greece, when they defaulted like a decade ago, was at about 180%. So like, we still got some wiggle room. And at being the empire, we probably have more wiggle room than most on how much debt we can take on. Like, the more I learn about this stuff, the more I realize, like, I think the United States can probably go much longer. I'm not saying it should. You should keep piling on debt, but it can go far longer on the credit card than other countries. Like, we don't have to be as fiscally responsible in a sense because we're the empire and the global reserve currency and all that stuff.
Right.
Not saying that's a great thing to just run up the credit card, but you know what I mean?
Sure.
And countries like Japan, they're running at 250% GDP, like debt to GDP, which is wild.
But they've paid a cost for that, right? You have a whole missing generation question. There's been recessions that were dramatic and terrible for them.
And it's mostly domestic bondholders too. Like, foreigners aren't really buying their debt. Mm-hmm. The benefit that America has is other countries buy our debt.
Right.
And that allows us to finance the nonsense that Congress just keeps spending on.
Exactly.
Right? I would say, now I've seen projections that with the Trump plan, with tariff revenues, if they go as what the plan says, with some of the economic impact with the proposed deregulations that are coming for boosting American economy and some of the manufacturing that's being brought in, I've seen projections of that might hit that debt to GDP ratio about 10 points. So it'd bring us down to like 110%. Mm. But like, still, like, we're over 100%.
And it depends, right? It's hard. It's a knowledge question. It's very hard to know, is how people will respond to this very dynamic, chaotic environment with their money, the things that they own, their labor turned into dollars.
Well, and also I was running through some numbers through Grok, and Grok was telling me that this bill, so currently we're at 121% debt to GDP ratio. This mm-hmm. bill would take us by 2034 to around 125 to 129%. So it's not like this massive increase in the debt to GDP ratio.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where you're still at, like, we should be chipping away at that.
Yeah, right. You know what I mean? If you're not going to do it now, when are you going to do it?
And it was the same thing as like my, what I think spending should be is like, I feel like you could drum up the political will, and maybe I'm naive for this. I feel like you could drum up the political will for pre-COVID level spending. Like just get to like 2019 yeah. spending levels.
For God's sakes, at least just do a 0% growth for a year, mm-hmm. right? Rather than building an inflation rate into every single year when you do a CR, like just hold it constant so that you can try to catch up. I mean, for God's sakes, at least do that, but they refuse to do that. And we see that from the CR from last year. We see that by them not putting in rescission. And where are the Doge cuts in here? Where they're doing a budget and spending bill. Why not at least codify ending of the Institute for Peace? Why can't we get rid of that thing?
Well, so I did see this clip from Byron Donalds, who is a pretty impressive congressman, actually. Like, I've grown to like him over the years. Benny Johnson interviewed him, and Benny was asking him like, what's next on the docket for Congress? Mm-hmm. And I think this is useful to like see what's on his mind. Now, there's a lot of question of like, will the Doge cuts happen and stuff? But he does talk about Doge cuts here. So I'll let me play this clip.
Is it Doge cuts? What's next? Codifying executive orders?
The Doge stuff, the rescission package, in my view, that's got to hit the floor. We have to see that package. Let's get this. Let the Senate get the big, beautiful bill to the president's desk. The rescission package needs to be the next thing. After that, we do need to look at we're going to have to do some farm bill stuff. Appropriations is coming. And I think we're going to have to start taking a look at FISA again. That comes up again next year. So that stuff's going to start coming into play. But yeah, monumental lift, you know, a lot of people had their hands in this. I know victory laps are being.
And he's going to go into the victory. So like, those are the things that are on the docket. Cause a lot of people are, cause this is one of the critiques is like, where are the Doge cuts? Right. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things where I'm like, did everything Elon do for nothing, you know? But so he's saying that there's a bill coming forward that's just not on the House floor yet that is Doge cuts. I hope that's true.
Just trust the plan, Kyle.
I hope that's true.
Just trust Speaker Johnson.
Well, that's the thing. I'm not a huge Mike Johnson fan.
Yeah,
that's
he
doesn't seem like the...
Was he an improvement on Kevin McCarthy? Maybe.
Yeah.
You know, but like that's up to his performance. And what has his performance been? And it hasn't been that great. Like
he's not an inspirational figure that kind of drives things. That's what I feel like is necessary. Like right now there's not a, I'm not sure how good he is at kind of whipping out all the votes and things like that appropriately for the types of things that we need from Congress. Like this is the problem is like, I'm liking a lot of stuff from the executive branch. I'm not liking Congress. You know? Like that's the problem with where I'm currently at right now.
Right, right. So the spending bits of this bill are the on the foundational concern for the folks. I'm sure that most of the conservatives are okay with the cuts. What are the cuts in the spending bits?
We'll kind of buzz through some of these. Like the big ones, this is actually like the primary focus, were Medicaid and SNAP. There's about $1 trillion worth of cuts to both Medicaid and SNAP over 10 years. I think it's something like $700 billion in Medicaid mm-hmm. and $300 billion in SNAP. And a lot of that comes down to work requirements. They're having this big target on able-bodied adults without dependents. Mm-hmm. That's kind of who they're targeting, is that you are going to be required to engage in work, job training, or community service for 20 to 30 hours per week. The CBO estimates that it'll be about 8.6 million people who would lose coverage by 2034. Now this has Democrats all in a tizzy, right?
Right.
Obviously.
So this is Obamacare reform, right? Mm-hmm. So Medicaid was at one point just very poor people. Obamacare really made it a much larger program that included a lot of folks that otherwise weren't eligible under Medicaid. So if you consider that 8.6 million people were not eligible for Medicaid as of 2007, those people would now be back in that category if they refuse to go to work, get job training, or do community service.
Yeah,
right. That's probably a more accurate descriptor.
Yeah.
We're just returning to 2007, but you still can get access to this, but you just got to actually work a little bit in order to get subsidized insurance costs.
You have to be, you have to make it appear like you're putting in the effort.
Yeah. 20 hours a week is not that much. 20 to 30 hours per week.
Yeah. And this, I mean, originally what I saw is that this was delayed until 2029, mm-hmm. but now it's 2026. So I guess this was part of the late night changes that were made, that this got
adjusted? What it was as far as my understanding is, there were other holdouts on the conservative fiscal hawk side. Mm-hmm. And one of the big ones is that we are delaying far too long any of the spending cuts, and this is going to create a very perverse set of incentives, especially when it comes to our security within the bond markets and our confidence in our ability to pay the debt. So we got to have something up front. And a lot of these things are all kicking in circa 2026. So they move Medicaid work requirements up to that point. Now, SNAP, you know, that also got moved up, but it was one of the things that is, it doesn't save as much money, but it is an important, like, this has been a long-term Republican goal, is SNAP is currently used to cover lots of its, a lot of it is actually administrative costs. It's moving that administrative cost to the states, and it's asking for, you know, more, the states to bear, because they actually were the ones who implement the program. The feds just fund it. So you're going to have to get a more efficient SNAP system. Now, SNAP is your subsidies for food for children.
Food stamps.
Yeah, food stamps.
The other major cut that we saw, so Medicaid and SNAP were the big ones. And then the other major one is phasing out the subsidies that come from the Inflation Reduction Act, which did none of those things. Because it was essentially
a green jobs bill.
It was essentially like a green energy project of like funding green energy stuff that has largely been not fruitful. Like, there's been no actual data that has been helpful.
Yeah. Really. I mean, so what was it? What was that? It was the World Economic Forum and that guy who did the documentary on climate change, Al Sharpton. He was a former vice president for Bill Clinton. I'm forgetting his name.
Bill Gore?
Al Gore.
Or is Bill?
Yeah, yeah,
Bill,
exactly. Bill Gore. I'm not the only one. Who remembers that guy's name? Where's he been?
Internet.
Exactly. Al Gore said,
which apparently, just an aside, people always joke about the creating the internet thing. I was listening to Mark Andreessen, and he said that, like, no, he didn't like create it, but he was like the fundamental senator that was the part of the internet creation and them working together. So people always kind of clown on that, but I just like, that just popped into my head.
It's an exaggerated claim. But yeah, what was I saying? You totally threw me off.
Sorry.
Damn it, Kyle.
Every time I think of Al Gore, I think about the internet.
Mark Andreessen. Oh yeah, what he admitted at the World Economic Forum that year was that it was called the Inflation Reduction Act, but really it was a new green deal.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is, you know, $1.5 trillion over 10 years of phasing out a lot of the, you know, tax benefits for specific industries. Of course, those are the ones that the Democrats like. They hate the yacht tax, but they love the New Green Deal tax. These taxes shouldn't exist. These tax benefits shouldn't exist in the first place for anybody. That would be an egalitarian system where you don't treat people differently based upon their behavior. You would treat it, you're a business, you pay this rate, simple. You get along.
Well, this was one of the big things. Like, this is a massive incentive changer for the economy. It was a massive incentive changer. So now we're going to be seeing incentives probably shift back to a more natural market phenomenon than what was before. Because it required everybody to be like, oh, well, I need these subsidies. So shift, pivot, you know, and you pivot on the energy side of like, oh, we're doing all this green energy stuff now, which takes away the mind share going towards things like natural gas, coal, all that stuff.
Right. So the green energy people for some time have been saying, hey, you know, we are competitive now. The technology's there. So we're going to see. We're going to find out. Are you actually able
to
compete?
Are you actually competitive without subsidies?
Yeah. Right. Now, there are, in a sense, some technical subsidies that traditional forms of energy get, especially when it comes to leasing on public lands to exploit those resources, although that is something that benefits green energy as well. Like, if you have some BLM land, you want to put a solar farm on it, that would technically be a subsidy. But since we own that land together in aggregate, that makes most sense to allow for a competitive leasing bid process where you can either put an oil refinery on it or oil pump on it or a green a wind farm. I think most people are going to find that, you know, when it comes down to it, that there are inherent material advantages to traditional energy resources. So we'll see, you know, more energy leases, which are in the bill as well. They do have some stuff on trying to streamline and make quicker energy releases for natural resource exploration.
The other big things, and now these are where we are seeing spending increases, mm-hmm. right? Was $70 billion to the border. That wouldn't make sense to me.
Why?
Like, but it's one of those things where it makes sense to me.
No, I think we're just running on the meme. We've already locked down the border.
My understanding
look
is
at the graphs.
My understanding is Homan is having a difficult time with the deportations just from a financial standpoint right now. Right.
Deportation is a different border. Right. Border was a policy question that was apparently solved, but Biden just refused to solve it. Trump comes in, locks down the border. We have.
I thought this goes towards deportation efforts and stuff like that.
Well, I don't know. You said border efforts here. I hadn't gotten any deeper than that. So if it's deportations.
Yeah, because my understanding is that this is very much within the Homan of stuff.
This is more ICE agents.
Yeah. I don't know necessarily the specifics of like where the money is being allocated to, but it's a lot of it is to help the efforts that Homan is having problems for. Because essentially every time he goes into a press conference, he's just like, we have all these people and we literally can't do anything with them. We don't have the funding for it. We don't have anything. Like it's impossible for us to actually kind of fix the problem at all in this. Like they've stopped the flow, but like then it's like now what to do after that? They're just like holding people and they can't really do anything with them. That's my understanding.
Huh. All right.
Yeah. Which is part of the reason for like the El Salvador stuff. With the super jail.
Right.
Right. Is because.
So we already solved the problem.
We literally.
I'm kidding.
Right? Like, that's the thing, we haven't.
We already got the deal with El Salvador. We just ship them all off. But I'm not sure if that's the right policy.
This is actually one of the areas where, like, on my bingo card, I was saying that there was going to be record high deportations, and that's not looking like it's going to happen this year.
Yeah.
Like, deportations are actually extremely low.
Right. Because they're dedicating their resources towards stopping the flow.
Yeah. But like, and they just don't have the resources for the deportations.
That's what government officials always say. I never have enough resources.
Well, it's not happening. So it kind of seems like that might be the case.
Yeah. Right? Well, you don't have a clear motive to suggest that they're underplaying their deportations. You think you're looking at Holman and you're like,
look at Holman and it's like, that dude wants to deport some fuckers.
right.
And he's just like, and it seems like, because that has been an area where I've been seeing like dyed in the wool conservatives angry at the Trump administration for the lack of deportations.
Right. Right.
Like that's like the Laura Loomers of the world are like, oh, they're failing, you know, like, so.
And I wonder how much of that is because of process concerns and process questions.
Some of that would be probably.
And you know, does more defense or more border spending actually change that? Maybe you can hire more lawyers so you can be more agile on your feet with your legal prosecution of the actual deportation. That might be it.
The other big thing is defense spending, which is a $150 billion increase. The Golden Dome, which is a futuristic missile defense system for protecting the homeland.
Uh-huh.
But then also just there's a lot of money carve-outs going towards Boeing and Lockheed Martin and stuff.
I was watching the Trump thing on this, and he literally says, like, we're going to build it in 3 years. I'm like, yeah, right. Like, they haven't even built the new Air Force One in 10, right? So, like, are you going to build, like, the largest missile defense system, including space systems?
Well, that's a Boeing problem. Boeing has plane problems.
Come on. Who's going to build this thing? It's going to be the same group of people who are working on, you know, Air Force One. And it's going to cost roughly $25 billion. And I'm like, if this is $500 billion, then I'll be like, that seems like a reasonable number.
Yeah, I'd be surprised.
Think of the sheer geography to cover the entirety of the United States and Canada. In the press release, he says, oh, and we're going to protect Canada too.
Well, we got to protect our 51st state.
He's not even getting anything out of that. Like, get something out of it, Trump. Like, if you're going to promise to protect Canada.
I wouldn't be surprised if some Carney negotiations happened when Carney was here.
Well, another part of that, too.
When it comes to that type of stuff. Because I know that was a big theme of the Carney-Trump meeting in the Oval Office is Carney was constantly talking about security aspects to our trade negotiations.
Okay.
So I wouldn't be surprised if those types of conversations are happening with because Canada did have, they're one of the few countries that retaliated on the tariff side. So I wouldn't be surprised if this ends up being as part of the 90-day negotiation period, we end up seeing some sort of like tit for tat defense stuff that goes on for the lower.
But prices. You would think Trump's normal negotiation posture would be like, I don't know, we might defend Canada, we'll see what they can give us. You know, you'd think that would be it, but he just gave it away. Second, who are we defending us from? These are for intercontinental ballistic missiles. Who has ICMBs?
Russia,
China.
China. I think that makes sense to me.
Iran has regional missiles. But it, like, one, Russia, we're going to be going into a trade deal with here, apparently. That's the recent news that I heard, that after the war's over, we're going to have
my exact prediction months ago.
Beautiful trade deal. So why would they shoot ICMBs at me?
I'm going to push back on that, actually, because, like, I think every nation is going to constantly be updating their defenses, because that kind of is their role, is a protection apparatus. So, like, this line of argumentation doesn't really make sense.
I'm not even making an argument. I'm just investigating, thinking through the topic, right? Yeah, so, like, at a minimum, escalatory spirals actually happen from arms races on internal domestic investment. So, Star Wars under Reagan was never really a thing that really ever came together that could actually shoot something down. If you want to check it out, Scott Horton has a really great breakdown on this with a couple different experts talking about just how difficult it is to shoot down an ICMB in space. And he's like, oh, it's going to be 100% accuracy, all these kind of things. That might be salesmanship, open to that. But what I worry about is another Star Wars-like boondoggle where we're spending a bunch of money on something that doesn't actually, neither provides an order of defense, nor does it really do anything other than enrich the coffers when we're broke. And then we're enriching the coffers of the military-industrial complex on a program that might not be there and might not be necessary, because we don't have to go to war with the South China Sea. We don't have to go to war with Russia. Iran can't hit us. North Korea is Trump's buddy. Who are we talking about?
Not anymore.
I'm being somewhat facetious there. But once again, their ability to strike us is minimized. And then additionally, that the logic of nukes is, if you can create an actual anti-nuke defense in your area, that creates a huge incentive for everyone else to try to create the same. And that increases the spiral of nuclear tension.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, to me, the...
Especially if it's false.
Like, to me, the Golden Dome itself makes sense, but I would like to see, on the kind of military-industrial complex side, I would like to see slim down and more efficient on stuff. Like, there's just a lot of bloat, and there's, like, my hopes is that we start to see some of that from Doge, because I know Doge went into the Pentagon, and all of a sudden everything just kind of, like,
disappeared.
People stopped talking. So, like, that's like an area where, and this is an area that Hegseth has been was talking about very heavily in the early stages of when he first came in, was talking about slimming things down and making things much more, like, efficient.
Yeah.
Because it's just the bloated stuff. But then there's, like, $1 trillion budget, and, like, there's, like, these types of talks that are happening as well. So, to me, the military on the defense side is always, there's always going to be an arms race of you're always needing to update more technology. So, like, I think that naturally spending is going to occur there. It's like all the other stuff, like the bloated, unnecessary stuff that becomes kind of like, ugh, to me, where it's just like, if we're just constantly adding new things and new things and new things without getting rid of, like, the bloat, that's where I'm like, ugh, guys, I wish that there was more of that.
Well, yeah.
That was,
I mean, in the case,
like, you have to live within your means here, right? And this is your means. I don't think that we need to increase military spending for that, for this project. I think that you needed to slim down other things to make this project work.
Yeah, right? If this was the case that they were going to cut the defense budget and then reallocating part of their defense budget to, you know, a Golden Dome, which is interestingly branded, right? Because it's like a play on the Israeli Iron Dome thing. Mm-hmm. What I worry about is it's a Golden Dome, because gold is not a good protector, right? And what we'll find is this is going to be another boondoggle, like the F-35 Raptor, like everything else that the Pentagon has been working on for a very long time now. And with, before the systemic changes happened, right? Do this in 2027 or something. Don't do this now, because right now you're feeding into the very system that is bankrupting us.
Let's jump into one final thing on the spending cuts, is the spending budget stuff, is the student loan program changes.
Mm-hmm.
This was something that I had missed, and you actually just kind of found right as we were going into this. What is going on here with the student loan stuff?
Well, what is claimed, and I'm kind of curious about this because this seems more dramatic and should be getting more coverage, is that the bill permanently ends federal subsidized loans for undergraduate students. And this means that interest will begin accruing immediately upon disbursement, removing the previous benefit where government covered interest during in-school and deferment periods. So that means if you take a college loan out for your undergraduate, you got to start paying on it immediately.
That's interesting.
Which is crazy. That would be very difficult for a lot of students to do.
But it's probably, maybe it's just because, like, you know, my exact policy on universities is that tanks should run through them. But I think that a lot of people just take like they go to college because they think that they have this free money. They're just like, I'll just get a job after and I'll pay for it. So like they're being very fiscally irresponsible in the actual act of going to college itself.
Sure.
When a lot of people should do other things. Like not everybody, college isn't for everybody. It doesn't like, so like, and this creates this massive bloat. So like there's a part of me that's almost, well, one, this is much more of a natural market structure of how loans would be handled. I think in a non-government interventionary environment. So like, I kind of like this, but a lot of people are going to hate it.
Oh, right? It's going to be a big deal. It's going to crush. They also got changes to the Pell Grants. They created a new working PI Pell Grant. They changed deferment and forbearance. They have new borrowing limits on government subsidized loans at $50,000 undergraduate, $100,000 graduate, and then professional students at $150,000 for the limit. So it's like attacking the college loan bubble from the opposite angle and not bailing them out, but rather by saying
from an actual market kind of angle.
About a little bit better. I agree.
Yeah. I like that in general. I think that's a good approach. You know, it's one of those things where I'm kind of surprised from a political wills perspective that this is a thing that you, especially because like this is something the Democrats will be able to take and run with and being like, they're making it harder to go to college and all blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah.
They hate education. You know, like that's the thing.
Right.
Well, and it's the same thing. Like I have clips, I'm not going to play them because we're running long, but I have clips from Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren, where like their entire critique of the bill is just like Trump's taking away healthcare. And
right,
you know, it's the same
thing,
bland talking points that we always see. So that is interesting to me is the college thing.
Well, we got one specific win in here that I hope makes it past the Senate. And that is this bill eliminates the $200 tax on gun silencers and it strikes a $200 tax on the manufacturer of gun silencers and praise Jesus, removes them from the regulatory purview of the National Firearms Act. Your gun muffler is free, everybody. We freed the gun mufflers.
But they're scary. They make the gun.
That's the thing that drives me crazy about it.
They make the gun longer and they go pew.
So there are things you can make like sensible arguments on receivers and stuff like that. All they allow for fully automatic fire and all that kind of stuff. But it's always been absurd that we make it so hard to get the thing that would save your hearings if you are in the event where you actually have to fire your gun. In the name of firearm safety, right? Because it's literally the thing that makes the gun more dangerous to shoot, and therefore people practice less, and therefore people aren't as good at shots. It's completely ridiculous, and it's probably the thing I like best on this thing, other than the child tax credit.
Well, and maybe so. This will be maybe the final thing before we close is just kind of running through the quick math of why there's reasons to be concerned here. Because, like, you know, strangely enough, we're critiquing the bill, but a lot of the things that we've talked about in the bill are things we're like, yeah, we like this thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So that might be a little confusing if you're just kind of looking at it from a passing glance.
Right.
The numbers that are important here. So there's about $5 to $8 trillion estimated in tax cuts, but the spending cuts are about $1.6 to $3 trillion, which equates to about a $4 trillion deficit increase.
Mm-hmm. Like, and that's over a 10-year period, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like that's where the concerns are, is the deficit increase. It's like in order for us to have these tax cuts that occurred, we needed to have something that offset that with the spending, is that we're still overspending despite like great tax cuts are going down. Now, this stuff doesn't take into account things like tariff revenue and things like the future economic growth that may or may not be happening. I saw the Tax Foundation. They had something like they expected GDP growth to go up like 0.6%, I think it was what it was.
Yeah, correct.
From this. So like that's going to increase tax revenue in certain ways that, you know, we're not necessarily projecting with off this simple math.
But even with that, they still predict $4 trillion in deficits,
exactly.
which is a substantial amount. And then why not just do it in a different order, right? Lead with the tax cuts, and then you could get all the conservatives on board, and not tax cuts, all the spending cuts with your DOGE rescission stuff, and then you can get the conservatives on board. But they constantly, and so that's what makes it feel.
That's the thing that seems strange,
like a rug pull.
That's
if
the
you
odd
just
thing.
Did it the fiscally sensible way that you yourself, Mike Johnson, has said would be more fiscally sensible. Lead with the cuts and then do the cuts and the tax cuts. Lead with the spending cuts, then do the tax cuts. And if he just had done that, I think this would not be what it is today.
Well, there's also just elements is like we're not seeing the growth yet on a lot of this stuff. Like we're not seeing the manufacturing move in. We're not seeing like, and those things are going to be like expansion to the tax base, all that stuff, right? So like
take a long time.
Like that stuff, we're not seeing that yet. So like, it's like, we're increasing the deficit before the growth is happening. And yeah. that makes the debt to GDP ratio that I was talking about earlier, like go higher, but like in theory it'll go back down, but it's like,
it depends
we
on,
we could have done a lot of these things in a different order. What? Like that's the thing where it's like,
right.
That's the deregulation stuff would have been really nice to have, in order for us to make like good assessments, because we don't know where that standpoint is going to be happening on a lot of things.
You could have at least done something that would have given confidence that doesn't actually change actually regulations on the books, right? You could have done the RAINS Act first. You could have done a lot of stuff. They should have the votes for that, accepting the Senate. So even if you were there, you could have been in a much better position to get those votes, but they decided not to. And that is why it is so easy to see it from Thomas Massie's point of view, because it's the same thing we've experienced over and over and over again. Every time the Republicans are in office, they do the same thing. They say, we're going to cut spending when they're running, and then they get in there and they don't cut spending, and then they cut taxes and they don't care about the deficit, and they're just running out that problem. That does end up itself affecting you. It isn't free money. Right, that money raises the quantity of supply of money in the system and creates inflation. It's not the only thing that creates inflation, but it's one of the variables that does create inflation.
There was a Scott Adams. He was going kind of viral this week. Unfortunately, not because of this, but he was he announced that he had stage 4 prostate cancer, and he's probably not going to live through the summer.
Exactly.
He's the Dilbert comic creator, but he was a big Trump supporter, and he had a clip that I saw floating around on Twitter that was. It was basically just him saying, like, all the little shit in the bill is really good. Mm-hmm. All the big shit is really bad.
Yeah.
Like, that's the unfortunate nature of it. And the big shit is the financial cliff that we are living on right now. And we're precariously walking closer to the edge. That's the big shit. And that's something that the bill does not address.
Yeah. And when we talked about the Trump's plan, the Bessent plan, maybe might be more accurate, to take the stool and remove a bunch of stuff and rearrange the entire global order in 4 years, our biggest viability was like, but can they cut spending?
And regulations. And regulations. Like that. It's a lot of that stuff.
Right? And regulations in regulations. Yeah, I have total confidence Trump could do that. He did that in his Trump 1.0. The question is, can he do it in a systemic way that really makes a difference, locks it in for the long term so you can actually do economic calculation, because economic calculation does not happen in 1-2 year periods. If you're going to say, I'm going to create a facility or I'm going to start a business, that's a 10-year plan. So you got to do stuff that's permanent. That means you got to pass bills. And when they're passing bills, it looks exactly like the bills we got during the Bush era. It doesn't look like, it's the same dynamic.
Yeah.
It looks exactly like the bills we got in Trump 1.0, and it isn't feeling different. And so like, you gotta change it up. I don't know why they think they can keep doing this without any kind of blowback.
There's an element here too is, and I don't know the exact political realities on how this was like, cause like a lot of these are backroom negotiations and things like that, is one of the big things that Trump had to get past this year was the tax cuts being permanent.
Correct.
From 2017.
Right.
So like how much of this is solely based on, that's a big leverage point on the Democrats and kind of the people that don't care about the fiscal side of like, if you want this political victory of making sure that those go in, sorry, deficit's going to keep going up. We're not cutting all this spending, right?
Right.
Like, there's probably a lot of that that's going on.
Yeah, that's behind the scenes too. That is a challenge. And definitely the people in the minority have the advantage in that case, because no matter what happens, Trump owns it.
Yep, exactly. Right?
So you know the Democrats are all going to vote against it, but those Republicans... Mm-hmm. The New York Republicans now get to scoot by and say, like, look, I work with Donald Trump and I got you the salt tax. But Thomas Massie, the guy who actually cares about it, is now going to get primaried by a Trump supporter.
Well, some of the thing there, too, is like...
It's the one-way ratchet in action.
Well, so oftentimes I see the Trump-Massie grandstander thing as more playful than anything. Massey's completely safe in his district. He wins by like 80% of the vote. He makes money every single time Trump does this to him.
Yeah.
I actually see the Trump-Massie dynamic kind of like I see the Trump-Powell dynamic, where it's more like playful ribbing rather than
frenemies.
Yeah, well, it's not even that they're like enemies. It's more so like it's Trump putting on a show. Mm-hmm. More so, and in a show that he knows doesn't mean anything on the Massie side, like Massey's not going to get primaried. Like he's not going to lose a primary. He's so beloved in his district. It doesn't even mean he makes millions of dollars every time Trump throws shade at him, like every single time. So it's like, I actually don't even think it's like, like, I don't even think it's that big of a deal. Right?
Like, well, I'm open to that. But once again, it's like that whole dynamic is set up so that you're in a result where your most responsible, best serving congressman is getting shade. And then your New York Democrat or Republican that just wants to, you know, get subsidies from the feds and increase deficits, they get to skate along unharmed. So yeah, you got to go grab it.
As we close out, I'll just show everybody for people that don't know. We do have a signed Thomas Massie debt badge that Joe got, and we have it sitting here on the studio set.
Yeah, so what's it at right now?
$36.2 trillion.
That's a lot of moolah. We should probably do something about that, Congress, please, if you don't mind. But we'll see what the Senate does. They're going to have their fingerprints all over it. This is going to be changing things. We're going to keep on top and keep you informed about it, because there's going to be a lot of media misdirection about it. Don't forget to join our Discord. Drop a comment below. Let us know what you think. Lot to discuss with our Qatar funders not coming through. We really need comments. Hit those comments. Join our Discord. Thank you so much for watching Human Reaction.
And we're going to be jumping into a skiff episode. So we do a whole nother show where we talk about other topics, sometimes very conspiratorial, sometimes more cultural, and so on. Mm-hmm. But we usually get a little bit more loosey-goosey in those ones. Yeah. Sometimes they go public, so the ones that are a little bit more tame. Uh-huh. But we're going to be jumping into that next. So if you want to support us, you can do that through YouTube or Substack.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much.
Peace. Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.